Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Still don't sound normal. It's been 6 weeks since I had a cold, and I still can't snap back from it. What's up, Sid?
You're fine.
I mean, I'm fine.
I mean, you just talk a lot.
That is true. I can't give my instrument the time it needs to recuperate.
You call it your instrument. That's your real problem, is you call it your instrument.
I was especially taxed during the Max Fun Drive. Because we recorded a lot of extra stuff and extra long episodes, and
I had to do so many podcasts. Oh, it was so hard.
Eat my butt.
It's what I love doing, and everybody loves me for it. And it was so difficult to do.
Kiss my grits. No, I want to thank everybody for being so generous during the drive. We had like 9,400 new and upgrading donors to the Maximum Fun Network.
Thank you all so much.
So much.
Your support means everything to us. We really appreciate it.
And because you all were so good to us, I am positive. Sydney assures me that we are going to have. Last week it was kind of a lot of poopy talk, and
I didn't realize how much poop would bother everybody.
Yeah,
I know it's something that, like, I understand that it's gross inherently. Yeah. Like, I get that.
Yeah,
but I kind of thought. It's one of those things that, like, when you're a little kid, you like to talk about poop. And then as you're an adult, you pretend like you don't like to talk about poop, but everybody secretly does. That is not the case. But a lot of you were a little unsettled.
A little put out by it. Now,
by it. And I am sorry for that.
So this week, Sydney promises that she's got something a lot more, less squirm inducing.
Yeah.
A lot more relaxed, just a light topic. So what do we got, Sydney?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who have been asking for me to talk about this for a while. And so, and I thought, you know, following on the heels of poop, what could be easier for everyone to deal with than blood? So I thought we would talk about hemophilia this week.
You don't actually think that's like, okay.
What do you mean?
You don't actually think that that's okay. Like, I know we all have a lot of fun here, but you don't think blood's like another cool topic. Like, you don't think that's like a chilled out topic.
Well, it's not. I mean, there's no like there's no fecal material in it. I mean, there shouldn't be. Hopefully there aren't. Like, there's not inherently there aren't bacteria in it. I mean, unless there's a problem. Like, it's a very it's clean. It's very sterile. It's just blood. It's like it carries oxygen and it's got all kinds of good cells in there that protect you from infection and clot you when you're hopefully when you're cut. I mean, like, it's great. Blood's great.
Is
blood gross?
I understand you're a physician and like, but you're also you have been swapped out with like a pod, some kind of pod person. Like, you still have human emotions and stuff, right?
Does blood, is that a bothersome thing?
Sydney, this is not, you're scaring me right now. You don't actually think this, right?
I really don't understand why blood is upsetting.
To some people, right?
It is in the emotional sense that, like, I don't want people to bleed because that's usually problematic. And so I am worried about their well-being or my own, certainly, if I am bleeding. It's gross, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm gathering from you.
Yeah, it's gross too.
Some people pass out with blood. I guess I didn't think of it. I don't know. Okay.
I'm sorry. Well,
I see where I've gone wrong.
Let's keep trucking.
All right. Well, a lot of people have requested this topic. Thank you, Andrew and Lauren and Sid. Not me. another Sid.
That would be weird.
Yeah, not, you're Sydney. Not thanking myself. See you. No, Sid and Sarah and Jolene and Diane and Mike. Thank you all for recommending this topic because it's very interesting and there's a lot of history. And I am sorry, I guess it is somewhat upsetting
yes.
for some people. Well, let's talk about it anyway.
Okay.
Do you know what hemophilia is?
It's when you bleed a lot and can't clot properly.
That's pretty good.
Thanks.
I'm impressed.
Thank you.
I think most people have like a passing understanding of hemophilia.
Cool. Kind of like a compliment and then diminish me like in the same breath. That's pretty cool.
I didn't mean to.
No, keep going. That's good.
Okay, sure. Most people are aware that it is a bleeding disorder, but it's actually kind of complex as to what causes it. I mean, okay. Why? Do you, I mean, I'm guessing you probably don't understand like what has gone wrong that someone has
probably some
bleeding issues.
Probably some blood cells not doing something properly, right?
Sort of like that. So our blood clots, and it's important that our blood clots, right?
Right.
Because not just because we accidentally bleed from time to time, you know, when we get cut or when we fall and scrape something or if something, you know, is going wrong in our colon or in our bladder or something. We bleed for lots of different reasons. But we also sometimes need surgery.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Sometimes we want to get something pierced.
And we need to get a tattoo.
There are lots of reasons why we would need our blood to clot. And there are lots of ways that our blood clots. There are lots of different factors involved.
Okay.
We call them clotting factors. So that's convenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like works on two levels.
There's a whole cascade of them that takes place if you were to get cut. A whole like domino effect of factors that get activated. We call that the clotting cascade or coagulation cascade. And then there are other things involved. Things like platelets you've probably heard of. Things called like fibrin and plasmin. And there are lots of different parts of your blood that are involved in clotting. The problem in hemophilia can actually be different. When we say the word hemophilia, we can mean different things. For instance, let's say that you have hemophilia A, because there are different types.
All right.
What that means is that you're missing factor 8.
Okay.
So that's one of the factors in the clotting cascade. This is why the disease was tricky to treat for a long time, because if you have hemophilia A, you've got the other parts of the clotting pathway. You don't have factor 8.
And is domino an applicable metaphor here in that if you take one out, it like the whole thing breaks down?
Others won't be activated, yes.
Okay.
And there are, I mean, it is... If you look at the clotting cascade, it's not a direct domino. It's almost like one of those really fancy domino setups with like a web where there are different dominoes that could hit one domino.
Okay.
So it is not as simple as to say if you're missing one factor, it just stops in the chain. There are other things involved and kind of other side pathways that can happen. But each factor is absolutely very important.
Okay.
And some are more important than others. And factor 8 is particularly important for its place in the cascade.
Okay.
Similarly, if you have hemophilia B, you're missing factor 9. And that is also very important in the clotting cascade. So different types of hemophilia equals missing different clotting factors. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Factor 8 deficiency, or hemophilia B, by the way, is also called Christmas disease.
Oh, festive.
So if you ever hear that, that's what they're talking about.
Did we talk about Christmas disease once?
We didn't. We talked about discussing Christmas disease for our Christmas episode.
Yes, right.
And then we didn't. But it's actually not named for the season or the holiday.
It's named for Herb Christmas.
Stephen Christmas.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Good, all right.
Good guess. But it was named for Stephen Christmas, who was the first person diagnosed officially with hemophilia B back in the 50s.
The first person to get it?
Yeah. Well, no, he wasn't the first person to have it. Lots of people had it, but the first person to actually officially be diagnosed with hemophilia B was Stephen Christmas. And so,
and he had to go and
Christmas
ruin,
disease.
Just ruin Christmas, just like that. You ruined the whole world. I mean, at least.
Stephen who stole Christmas.
At least his name wasn't Stephen Pizza. That would have been bad.
Pizza disease?
Pizza disease. That would be.
I call that heartburn.
Bark, 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 bark. Fart noise. Okay, go ahead.
It is, hemophilia is an X-linked disease. Do you know what that means?
Absolutely not.
Justin, you had some genetics at some point in science class.
Oh, yeah. Does that mean it affects mainly men?
You read ahead.
I did.
Okay. Wait, sure, it does,
you
Justin.
You put me on the spot. You could have just let my ignorance lie, but you had to put me on blast and like really do that thing that I love where you're like, are you sure you're a dummy? And I had to be like, no, I am for sure a dummy. So I got defensive. I got, you know what? I don't have your knowledge base, but you know what I do have?
What's that?
Savvy.
Okay, Justin. So you know it largely affects
Kobayashi Maru, my Kirk over here reprogramming the whole simulation.
Sure. Why would an X-linked disease largely affect men?
Because men have XX.
Nope.
Men have XY.
Backwards. Okay.
Men have XY.
Anyway, when we're talking purely, and again, this is purely based on genotype. We're referencing kind of some gender terms.
Sure, men are XX. Men are XY. Men are.
Okay, if we are talking genotypically male.
Sorry, I should have been more specific.
Yes, genotypically male. XY.
Okay.
Genotypically female, we say, is XX.
Got it.
Okay, got that.
Got it.
So we're talking purely about sex chromosomes at this point, and not the larger issue of gender. But an X-linked disease means that the gene, the problem gene that's causing hemophilia, is on the X chromosome. So a woman genotypically has two X chromosomes, mm-hmm. whereas a male would have one.
Okay.
So if you're getting your X chromosome from your mother, which you do, right? If you are born a male, mm-hmm. you get an X chromosome from your mom and a Y chromosome from your daddy.
Right.
Okay. You can't get a Y chromosome from your mom because
she doesn't have one.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. So if you only have one X. So if you get the affected chromosome from your mom, that's it. You've got hemophilia.
Okay.
Because you only got one X. Whereas a female gets two X's. So she's going to get an X from her dad, who either has hemophilia or doesn't, and then an X from her mom, where she's rolling the dice. One of those X's has hemophilia, the other one doesn't. So a woman is going to probably not be affected because she's got a good gene on the other X chromosome.
Okay.
The only way a woman could be affected is if both mommy and daddy give her an affected X.
Okay,
got it. Statistics on that are just low.
Okay, interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. You don't get it, do you?
I do get it.
I'm going to draw you some Punnett squares later.
No, I'm like Gregor Mendel over here. I got it.
This dates back to ancient times, most likely, hemophilia does, even though we don't see like the word hemophilia dating back to ancient times. But there are some hints of it. For instance, you know, circumcision is something that has been practiced in the Jewish faith for a very long time. And there are provisions specifically that you can find throughout kind of ancient history and in the Talmud where they say if you have two male infants, like two brothers who both die during circumcision, mm-hmm. then you have another male in that family, they actually do not have to go through circumcision. There's actually provisions that say you can forgo it. The thought process being that if two boys in the family had bleeding problems to the extent that they died following circumcision, the third may as well. And this is kind of an understanding of a genetic disease, even though we didn't understand what it was yet, you know?
Yeah, I think it's weird that it takes two. Like, for me as a parent, if my first kid beefed it after he got circumcised, I would be like, you know what? Let's leave it on. We're good.
I mean, it may have just been, you know, may have just been a chance at that one.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not a risk taker. After my first kid did that whole thing, I'm just going to go ahead and stick that foreskin right on there.
I think that's fair. I think my scientific inquiry probably ends where my child begins.
Right.
For me personally.
Yeah.
There is mention in the Bible of a woman who had hemorrhages for like 12 years, and then Jesus healed her of those hemorrhages, just these bleeding episodes. So that could have been a reference to hemophilia. Because let me mention, hemophilia can affect women. It's just much more common.
I got it.
And there was Abulcasis, who was an Arabian physician from the 10th century, who wrote kind of these like pedigrees, these histories of families where there were men in them who bled to death and nobody knew why. So people sort of understood that there was this genetic bleeding disease, but nobody knew why it was happening or exactly how it was passed from person to person. And it would seem to skip generations and nobody knew why.
Okay.
Now, before I get into how we figured all this out and some of the crazy things we tried to do for it before we knew what to do for it, I think this is a good moment to talk about why hemophilia is known sometimes as the royal disease or the disease of kings.
Okay.
You may know this, Justin, but hemophilia played a major part in the royalty of Europe.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Have you heard that reference?
I don't know how, but yeah, I know basically.
So I'm going to try to walk you through some of this because there's some interesting facts. But let me recommend that if you're really interested in understanding it, right now you go Google like European royal family hemophilia pedigree. Something to the some mixture of those words.
Okay.
You know, hemophilia, pedigree, royal family, something like that. Pedigree is like one of those charts of inheritance.
Does this happen on stuff you missed in history class? They say like, listen, guys, we're going to try our best here, but just Google it.
I just think this is something that, no, I think if you could see it, if you can see the family tree, it's easier to follow.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to give you a lot of names and who had hemophilia and who didn't. And I think if you can see the little boxes and they're like, this one is shaded for a carrier and this one is colored this color if it's a person with hemophilia. I think it's easier to see.
Okay. Got it. I'm with you.
So Queen Victoria of England, mm-hmm. who reigned from 1837 to 1901.
So I remember from the Doctor Who episode with the werewolves.
Perfect. Okay. She was a carrier for the hemophilia gene. Okay.
Okay.
So she was not a hemophiliac. She did not have hemophilia. But she had it on one of her X chromosomes, right?
Mm, right.
So she carried it and could pass it along to her children.
With you.
Which she did. So let's start talking about some of her children. We're going to talk first about Leopold. Leopold was her eighth child, her fourth son, and he had hemophilia. He had hemorrhages throughout his life. You can get spontaneous bleeding, not just like when you get cut, you bleed a lot, or you can get a nosebleed that won't stop. You can get spontaneous bleeding in your joints, worst case scenario in your brain. So yes, it can be a very crippling, dangerous disease, or at least at that point in time it could have been. Mm-hmm. And it was for Leopold. He died from a brain hemorrhage as a result of it. But before he did, he had some kids, which is important. On a side note, he had a couple different doctors. One of them was Jenner. You've probably heard of Jenner.
No.
Dr. Jenner. Okay. No. He studied him and he came up with a theory based on studying Leopold that hemophiliacs just had more blood than the average person.
Had to let it off, like let off steam. Yeah.
And they had really small blood vessels, so it just kind of spilled out all the time. That's not true. His second doctor, Dr. Legg, thought that staying in warm climates would help, which is why Leopold spent a lot of time where it was warm. He actually died in Cannes in France. Mm-hmm. But strangely, Legg also advocated in papers that he wrote on the subject that men with hemophilia not be allowed to marry or have kids, which is weird because Leopold did both of those things.
Yeah.
And if the royal family kind of had wind of this, you would have think they may have thought like, well, this is not going to be good for our mm-hmm. descendancy.
Yeah, let's weed out this particular branch from the family tree.
Exactly. But they didn't. They didn't seem to mind. They actually wanted to keep it all kind of under wraps and secret. Which they were pretty good at doing.
Some people, awkward dinner parties, I'm assuming, when people just started bleeding out of their joints.
Well, not like into your joints. Like your knee will get all swollen.
Yeah.
There's blood in there.
Yes. Percival? My lord, Percival? Is that blood coming from your tear duct? Percival?
That's excuse not how this works.
No, mother, it's some tomato sauce. Mother, no. Percival? Are you bleeding from your ear holes? No, mother. You're embarrassing me, mother.
When Leopold died...
Okay, right. I'm sorry, mother.
This is on you. I'm not making this hard.
All right.
When Leopold died...
We got a lot
died,
to get through, Sid. You got to pick it up.
I know. I'm sorry. This is the most interesting part, though.
Okay. Okay. This next sentence or the whole thing? Sorry.
When Leopold died suddenly... there was no mention of what he died from, even though it was very clear that he died from complications related to hemophilia. But if you looked at journals from the time, the Lancet and the British Medical Journal, which were both, you know, very popular at the time and still are, there were obituaries for him published in both journals, and also huge articles about hemophilia.
Alternately facing pages.
Exactly. Like, we're not going to, it was like out of respect for the royal family. Like, we're not going to say it, but we kind of all know. Like, he's right. had two doctors who are experts in hemophilia who are his personal doctors.
Right, yeah.
We're not stupid. But a good note, Leopold's death actually hugely accelerated research in the area of hemophilia.
Mm-hmm. So, I bet Leopold would wish we'd maybe gotten on that a little bit sooner, but okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
His daughter Alice was a carrier of it, and she also had a son who had it. More importantly, though, Queen Victoria had two daughters who were carriers. So Leopold's, sisters. Okay.
Okay.
Alice was one daughter. She would give birth to a son with hemophilia and two carrier daughters, okay? Carriers are people who aren't affected but continue to carry the gene along, right?
Right.
So Alice's two daughters, so Queen Victoria's granddaughters, this is important. One was Irene. Irene married Prince Henry of Prussia, bringing the hemophilia gene into what would later become like members of the German royal family.
Okay.
So this is where, like, hemophilia starts to become part of the German aristocracy. Mm-hmm. Alexandria almost married Prince Albert, her cousin Prince Albert. He proposed to her. She refused because she didn't love him. And if she had married him, she could have introduced hemophilia into what is now our current British family, like the current line of British royalty. But she refused. Instead, she married Nicholas, the Tsar of Russia.
Oh, gosh.
Gave birth to Alexei, who did, of course, have hemophilia and who was tended mainly. Do you know who was the main person, medical person to take care of Alexei?
Rasputin,
exactly. Who was thought to be the only person who was able.
From downtown, Smurl. You can't give me anything for that? Sheesh.
I'm impressed. I don't have a fancy sheet of paper in front of me, okay?
I'm flying by the seat of my brain here.
That was good, though.
Yeah, no kidding. It was good.
Okay, I'm impressed.
Woof.
I'm impressed.
Now I know how Rasputin felt when he got stabbed all those times, because
I've wounded you.
You've wounded me deeply, my wife.
Rasputin was thought to be able to alleviate Alexei's suffering, largely through hypnosis.
Sure.
And of course... Fine. I don't know. Of course, the strain of the illness and the effects of Rasputin on the royal family were supposedly, you know, big factors, thought to be big factors in the Russian Revolution that would follow.
Right.
Right. One interesting side note, a couple. One, Prince Albert, who Alexandria almost married, who would have maybe revisited, you know, hemophilia on the current British royal family. Prince Albert for a while was thought to be Jack the Ripper.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there were some theories floating around about that. He wasn't, though. Don't worry. Although Irene and Alexandria both were carriers, as we've demonstrated, and carried on, you know, the gene to different royal families, she also gave birth to a daughter who wasn't a carrier, Alice. This is important because... Again, another close call for the current royal family. Alice gave birth to Prince Philip, who, of course, is currently married to Queen Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Another opportunity for it to kind of affect the current family, but it didn't. The other part of this that's interesting is Beatrice, who we really haven't talked about yet. She gave birth to two affected sons, as well as a daughter who was a carrier, Victoria, who married King Alfonso XIII of Spain. Bringing hemophilia to the Spanish royal family. None of the current members of any royal families are affected by hemophilia, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so don't worry about that. Everybody's going to be just fine.
I was very, very worried about the European aristocracy. Thank you. Or I guess, is aristocracy even accurate if we're talking about royal families? There's probably... another word for it.
I don't know.
Anyway, I don't know.
Anyway, so there you go. There is hemophilia and all the European royal families and why everybody... It was all Queen Victoria.
So, in closing, go Google it. So, how did we start to understand hemophilia a bit better, Sid?
Justin, I'm going to tell you about that, but first, why don't you follow me to the billing department?
Let's go.
I'm Jesse Thorne, the host of Bullseye. Bullseye's your guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, I'll sit down with people like Elvis Costello, Elizabeth Banks, and Spike Lee to talk about their creative work and their lives. Find your new favorite TV show, book, movie, or album and gain new insights into the things you already love. That's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
So, Sydney, I'm ready to take a stand against hemophilia, and I hope you are too. How do we start to fight back?
So in the 1800s, we finally began to understand hemophilia a little bit. First, there was John Conrad Otto, a doctor from Philadelphia, who traced back familial, what he called bleeders, in different families. And then the term hemophilia actually didn't come about until 1828. A researcher in Zurich, Friedrich Hopf, who finally named it hemophilia.
Now, so does hemophilia mean like you love it, like you're crazy for it? Like, so it's like you're crazy.
Yes,
for,
I mean, like you it love could to be bleed, like you're crazy to, about it. Well, I mean, it's like you're prone to bleeding, is what this is really
right.
Like apt to bleeding.
Mm-hmm. It's not. And like hemo means
yeah.
blood.
Yeah, it's not like you just really love bleeding.
Just love to bleed.
No, that's not. I don't know.
No, that's not right.
But I can understand why you would think that.
Thanks.
Throughout the mid-1900s, we started to discover all the different types of hemophilia by different factors. As we were able to isolate different clotting factors in the blood, then we began to understand
stuff like blood typing and more. Yeah,
exactly. So then we began to figure out different things. But even as we began to understand that people had problems clotting and that there were different factors involved in clotting, and that was the problem, we still didn't have a great way to treat it because we didn't have a great way to store blood yet.
Oh, right.
We didn't know exactly how to. Yeah, it took us a while to figure out how to break it all down. And then it took us a while to figure out how to keep it fresh. And so often if you were to get a blood transfusion, it would be a straight, fresh, whole blood transfusion from a family member was mm-hmm. kind of like our best bet. Like, I don't know, let's get somebody you're related to because then it's probably fine. And we're just going to take blood out of them and put it directly in you.
That'd be exhausting. You'd be like following around your cousin, like, please don't trip. Please. Please. No, don't fight that bully. I'll fight him for you. It's fine. Fine. Ugh.
This was obviously less than ideal. It might not have matched. And if you look at the average life expectancy when we go back to the early 1900s, it was like 13. Wow. So obviously we needed better treatments. And there was a lot of other stuff tried at this time, stuff that wasn't necessarily great ideas. Calcium was one of the earliest things recommended. There was some thought that maybe if you didn't maybe you didn't have enough calcium in your blood. Hmm. So calcium salts were prescribed. People started taking extracts of like thyroid gland and bone marrow and injecting it into people, thinking maybe that somehow would make you stop bleeding. Oxygen was a common treatment. I don't know. I mean, yeah. I guess it doesn't hurt.
No.
Lyme was thought to be a treatment for a while.
Absolutely not. I can call fake-a-roo on that one.
Hydrogen peroxide was popular, which I guess I can kind of understand that in the sense that, like, I feel like I have lots of people I see who will have any kind of wound or ailment, and they'll just kind of dump some hydrogen peroxide on it. So I can see where that's
That was my dad, man. When I was a kid, I have so many memories of my dad hurting himself and just dumping half a bottle of hydrogen peroxide. I think because it foams up a little bit, you think, like, there it goes.
There, it's really helping.
Yeah, it's getting in
just
there.
Just don't do that.
No?
No.
No?
No.
Is it not good for anything?
It's not really helping very much.
Not with anything?
No.
Oh, no. Really,
it's not. I mean, I guess if you're going to use it once, it's not really going to. It's not. No, don't do that ever.
Okay,
using
I did that a lot.
No, don't gargle. What? No, don't gargle hydrogen peroxide.
It's like a solution mixed with water.
No, don't do that.
Oh, man.
No. Like, if you want to dump it on a cut, I guess that's fine. But then please stop dumping it on the cut because you're just going to inhibit healing. Okay. So, like, if it makes you feel good to do it the one
What's
time.
What's it for?
I don't know. People like the foaming. They feel like it's, helpful.
You can have the same effect of dumping a bottle of Dial on it.
When was the last time you went to a doctor and they dumped hydrogen peroxide on you?
I assume I'm going for like a folklore, like home remedy type thing. Uh-huh. I assume they got better stuff there.
And if you've listened to our show a lot, you know that those folklore home remedies always work so well.
Okay. This has been very eye-opening, but thank you. I appreciate it.
Gelatin was recommended, which I can see where like people thought like, I don't know, that makes things sticky.
Sticky, yeah.
In the 1930s, diluted snake venom was used.
Okay.
Because there were some snake venoms that could cause you to clot. So that was probably dicey. That was risky business. In the 1950s, there was one doctor who kind of started recommending you let bees sting you. Like literally, like he had hives and he would like hold a bee to your skin until it stung you. Can you imagine being that kid who's just sitting there watching the bee, knowing that like the goal here is at any second it's just going to sting you?
Yeah.
Birth control pills were recommended, which actually isn't a crazy thought, because we know that birth control pills, estrogen treatments in general, can put you at higher risk for clotting.
Oh, okay.
So obviously this was not the best course of treatment, right. But this is not crazy thinking. As opposed to peanuts, which were recommended by one doctor who had hemophilia, who noticed that he had a bleeding episode stop suddenly one day, and he connected it to when he ate a handful of peanuts. And so for a while, peanut extract was given to people.
That we're just going for it, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I like peanuts, but... even once we figured out how to give people plasma, there's so little of each clotting factor in like a whole big thing of fresh frozen plasma, blood plasma, that you would have to give kids tons of plasma in order to replace enough of the clotting factors they were missing.
Something that's like a finite resource, that's kind of tricky.
Exactly. And like you're just trying, and you wouldn't be doing this unless the kid was already bleeding. So you're trying to shove as much of this into a kid who's bleeding as fast as possible to try to stop the bleeding. And it was not a great situation. So by the 1960s, we really hadn't improved stuff much. To the life expectancy was just under 20. So in those years that followed, we had a lot of great breakthroughs. In 64, the clotting cascade was published in Nature, and we really began to understand all the different things that were involved, the process. In 65, Dr. Judith Graham figured out that if you thawed out plasma, those bags of frozen plasma, if you thaw it out, the stuff that the precipitate that's left... it's called cryoprecipitate. It's just this really concentrated stuff that contains a ton of factor VIII.
Huh.
And when she figured that out, you could give that to patients instead of the whole bag of plasma. And it was a really concentrated solution of what they needed. So you give them a lot less, a lot faster.
It's like pan with a scrapings ton more. After you have cooked the steak. That's exactly. Just the really, really good stuff.
Exactly. This was the really, really good stuff that hemophiliacs needed. After that, we figured out how to give just single factors, and we started making like, here's a bag of factor VIII, here's a bag of factor IX. And we started giving people prophylactic treatments so that instead of just treating them when they bled, you could come in and get regular injections of things to stop you from bleeding, okay. Right? To give you what you needed so you wouldn't bleed so much. And then we started making synthetically available factors, and we had to start finding ways to, because some people's bodies started fighting back and creating antibodies against things, and we found ways to circumvent that as well. And without getting into it, it started to become much more manageable. The only major setback, and I won't belabor this point, but I think you can't talk about hemophilia without mentioning it, was in the 80s. Which we were figuring out better and better ways to give people blood products, but we had not yet figured out screening for blood products. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of major setbacks for people who have hemophilia in the 80s because of HIV, and then after that, hepatitis C. A great number of people with hemophilia were affected by HIV and hepatitis C as a result of these transfusions.
How do you mean? There weren't enough blood
screening. We weren't screening blood products for these things. So they got HIV.
Oh, okay.
As a result of that. So obviously we are much, much better at that process now. Mm-hmm. And it is exceedingly rare that you would ever get something like that from a transfusion.
Okay.
Thank goodness. In addition, we have new drugs. We have recombinant stuff. Like I said, synthetics. We need less frequent injections. There are new drugs coming out now because it used to be something you would have to get an injection of almost every single day.
Wow.
Yeah, to prevent bleeding episodes. We're getting much better. It's still really expensive. It's still pretty time consuming, but we're trying to make that a better process. And now there are gene therapy trials underway to find ways if we could inject patients with hemophilia with the genes that they need to make those clotting factors, and they would become like part of their own DNA, and then they could make some of that factor or maybe enough of that factor on their own.
Yeah.
So those trials are now underway to see if maybe we could find an even better way of treating it. So
Well,
come a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially from a life expectancy of 13. That's awesome.
It's amazing when you look at, I mean, this has all just really been in the 1900s and largely since the 60s. I mean, that's really, that's that recent that stuff has gotten so much better.
Wow, that's wild. If you are somebody who's living with hemophilia, we'd love to hear from you. Sawbones@MaximumFun.org is our email address. We always like to hear from people who have a little more firsthand experience with these topics than we do.
Yeah.
We are at Sawbones on Twitter. We are sawbonesshow.com. If you ever want to link somebody to our program, or you can just send them our iTunes link. I believe it's itunes.com/sawbones will work just fine.
And if you do check us out on iTunes and you feel so inclined, why don't you give us a review and let us know what you think?
Yeah, that's really the only way we have of helping the show to grow, because we don't do advertising or anything like that. We just rely on your word of mouth. So please like our show on Facebook and in our Facebook group. If you want to join that, it's Sawbones. Sawbones. Come on over.
Also, please like our show.
But please just like it. Just like it.
Because we like you.
Hey, we liked you first. I think that's going to do it for us. Oh, thanks to the taxpayers for letting us use their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. Go search for them on the internet, and you can download all their music and give them a lot of money for it. An exorbitant fee, I should think.
And thank you again, everybody who helped us out in the Max Fun Drive or just listened and told their friends about it. We appreciate it so much.
We do. But until next Wednesday, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.